morning. It's Thursday, May 4th, 2006, and this is the KBOO Morning News. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Coming up on this program, a judge ruled yesterday that Portland's Urban Renewal Agency does not need to pay state-imposed minimum wages for construction workers. Amnesty International says that torture and inhumane treatment of people in custody by the U.S. is widespread. And Mexico has backed off the decriminalization of some drugs after pressure from the U.S. Weather for today calls for sunshine with highs in the mid to upper 70s.
With time running out to reauthorize an act that provides funds for rural schools and roads in Oregon and other states, Senator Gordon Smith asked the Senate to take emergency action, according to the Salem Statesman Journal. The Secure Rural Schools and Self-Determination Act, which offers money to communities with large tracts of federal land that cannot be taxed, is set to expire at the end of September. Smith asked his Senate colleagues to grant an emergency extension for 1 year as part of a spending bill that includes funding for Hurricane Katrina relief and the war in Iraq. So far, the act's reauthorization has stalled because there's no clear funding source. Two options have been proposed, but neither has garnered much support. One would pay for the program through the sale of federal forest land. Another, supported by Senator Ron Wyden, would use money from taxes withheld on federal payments to government contractors. The Senate did not vote on Smith's amendment, but Senate leaders said they will work to find a funding source through other legislation. Smith told his colleagues that paying for the program is a federal obligation because financial problems in timber-dependent rural communities are the result of federal regulations restricting logging.
Privately hunted deer and elk would be allowed to remain on a national park island off the coast of California under legislation approved late yesterday by a congressional panel. This from the Salem Statesman Journal. The House Armed Services Committee passed a measure despite objections from the National Park Service that trophy game hunts on Santa Rosa Island restrict public access and interfere with native species. The 53,000-acre island, 40 miles off Santa Barbara, is part of the Channel Islands National Park. The federal government bought Santa Rosa Island for $30 million in 1986 from a local ranching family. Litigation among the family, an environmental group, and the National Park Service resulted in a court deal to end the family's hunting concession by 2011.
A redevelopment project involving Portland's Urban Renewal Agency does not have to pay state-imposed minimum wages for construction workers, a judge ruled Wednesday. The Bureau of Labor and Industries had claimed that private construction projects receiving tax money and under government control should pay so-called prevailing wages. But the Portland Development Commission, or rather the Portland Development Commission, contended it did not control the construction project at issue. Multnomah County Circuit Judge Henry Cantor agreed with the commission and rejected the prevailing wage claim. At stake was only $225,000 in additional wages, but developers were concerned the case would set a precedent that could boost the cost of future public-private redevelopment and affordable housing projects. The Development Commission sued the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries after the state agency said the prevailing wage must be paid for a Northeast Portland project. The commission contended the prevailing wage could increase costs by up to 30%, although the state agency says it would be less.
The jury has finally decided that Al-Qaeda plotter Zacharias Moussaoui is to face life in jail rather than execution for his role in the 9/11 attacks. The prosecution had called for the death sentence, arguing that there is no place on this good earth for him. But defense lawyers successfully argued he should face life in prison rather than martyrdom through execution. During 6 weeks of testimony in a Virginia court, prosecutors had argued he withheld information that could have helped prevent the attacks on New York and Washington. Under cross-examination, Moussaoui said he had no regret or remorse and wished it could be September 11, 2001 every day. Although he was in jail at the time of the attacks, prosecutors said he told lies to allow the plot to continue. Although full of details of the jury's vote have not been made public, a court spokesman said the verdict in favor of life imprisonment was not unanimous. This from the BBC.
A senior U.S. official says widespread allegations of illegal CIA activities in Europe is hurting intelligence cooperation between the United States and European governments. John Bellinger, a legal advisor to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, spoke at the European Parliament today. He said the furor over the issue is undermining intelligence cooperation. Bellinger did not deny there have been CIA flights over Europe or with stopovers in Europe, but he says the implication they all had detainees on board is absurd. He says the flights may have carried intelligence experts, counterterrorist officials, or forensic evidence. EU lawmakers said last week data from the Union's air traffic agency show there have been over 1,000 clandestine CIA flights over European territory since 9/11. But they said it is not clear if or how many detainees were on board.
And according to Reuters, Amnesty International said yesterday that torture and inhumane treatment are widespread in U.S.-run detention centers in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Cuba, and elsewhere despite Washington's denials. In a report for the United Nations Committee Against Torture, the London-based human rights group also alleged abuses within the U.S. domestic law enforcement system, including use of excessive force by police and degrading conditions of isolation for inmates in high-security prisons. It said that while Washington has sought to blame abuses that have been recently come to light on aberrant soldiers and lack of oversight, much ill treatment stemmed from officially sanctioned interrogation procedures and techniques. The UN committee is scheduled to begin consideration of the United States tomorrow, and the last review was in 2000. It said in November it was seeking U.S. answers to questions including whether Washington operated secret detention centers abroad and whether George W. Bush had the power to absolve anyone from criminal responsibility in torture cases. The committee also wanted to know whether a December 2004 memorandum from the U.S. Attorney General's office reserving torture for extreme acts of cruelty was compatible with the Global Convention barring all forms of cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment.
A court in London is expected to rule today on an appeal to intervene in some Guantanamo prisoner cases. They involve three men, Jamil El-Banna, Omar De Gaius, and Bishr Al-Rawi, who lived in England but were not citizens there. Up until recently, the British government has refused to take up the case of prisoners who were residents but not British citizens. It did get the release of eight British citizens held as terror suspects at the U.S. base in Cuba. Two judges have been asked to declare that Foreign Secretary Jack Straw's refusal to make presentations on behalf of the men was not backed by law.
Bush appealed for quick passage of a $70 billion in tax cuts yesterday, saying that lower taxes on dividends and profits from investment sell-offs have helped revive the economy. In addition to extending those cuts by 2 years, the proposal would keep 15 million taxpayers from getting hit this year with the tax aimed at the wealthy. Bush also said raising taxes would harm the economy, especially at a time of rising gasoline prices. Republicans are worried about growing voter unhappiness over soaring pump prices in an election year and hope to show that the GOP-controlled Congress can address pocketbook issues. They want to pass long-stalled legislation to extend, through 2010, a 15% tax rate for dividends and capital gains. Democrats said the idea would appease wealthy investors and do little for the middle class. Without the extension, the tax rate on capital gains, profits made on the sale of investment, will rise to 20% after 2008. Dividends would be taxed at marginal tax rates as high as 39.6%.
The Canadian dollar, or loonie, is pecking at the heels of the usually more robust U.S. greenback, according to the BBC. Traditionally the poor neighbor, one Canadian dollar is now worth 90 U.S. cents. Some analysts say it may soon be on par with its American namesake. The U.S. dollar has weakened against most main currencies in recent weeks, while the Canadian dollar has gained on optimism about Canada's economy. The Canadian dollar gets its nickname from a loon bird depicted on the coin. Washington has seen the dollar weaken to a number of factors, including concern over America's ongoing trade deficit and recent suggestions by U.S. Federal Reserve Chief Ben Bernanke that the current cycle of U.S. interest rate rises may be coming to an end. While the strength of the Canadian dollar is good news for Canadians traveling to the U.S. and Canadian firms importing from the U.S., it makes things difficult for Canadian companies exporting south of the border. The Canadian dollar has not traded above 90 cents since 1978.
George W. Bush has declined to meet with Norwegian Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg at the White House, this from Zewanet. Norwegian Broadcasting reported that Bush's staff would not arrange the meeting because of the Norwegian left-center coalition government's criticism of the war in Iraq and the finance minister's support for a boycott of Israeli products. Jan Petersen, who was Norway's foreign minister in the last center-right government, said that he feared a phone conversation Prime Minister Stoltenberg had with Bush shortly after last fall's election put a damper on relations between the United States and Norway. During the phone call, Stoltenberg told Bush that he would order the withdrawal of Norwegian officers from Iraq. A professor at the University of Oslo said her sources also indicate that Norway is no longer part of the inner circle at NATO.
In Baghdad today, at least 9 people were killed and 46 injured in a suicide bomb attack outside a courthouse. This from the BBC. The bomber exploded his device near a convoy of police vehicles on a main road in the mainly Shia Sadr City area. Meanwhile, at least 5 civilians died in a U.S. raid on a house in the city of Ramadi, although the U.S. military has not confirmed this, but did confirm that an operation had taken place and did not give any other information. Hospital and police officials said that the 5 civilian deaths happened when U.S. aircraft bombed a house about 70 miles west of Baghdad. The area of the suicide bomber attack in Baghdad was crowded with people submitting petitions to the court and others drafting documents for petitioners. The violence, which has claimed dozens of lives in recent days, comes as Iraqi politicians try to form a government of national unity.
In Baghdad yesterday, negotiations continued over posts in the new government nearly 5 months after it was elected. David Enders files this report from Baghdad.
The government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is unlikely to be formed for at least a week, and even when it is completed, it will be dealing with the same major issues that have plagued Iraq for the last 3 years. Already, Sunni Arab politicians are calling for amendments to the constitution passed last October that would give the country's central government fewer powers than it had in the past. But last week, there was renewed debate within the U.S. Congress over whether Iraq should simply be broken into 3 separate states. Proposals of this nature are supported by Kurdish leaders, who are unwilling to relinquish the autonomy they have enjoyed since 1991 and have been solidifying by making oil deals with foreign companies independent of the central government, as well as employing their own visa rules. Shiites in some southern provinces would also like to be able to deal with their oil wealth independent of the central government, while Abdul Latif is the former governor of Basra province, the center of the country's southern oil fields, and a current member of the National Assembly.
I am with this idea. It is the only way to have rights for all Iraqis. I hope Basra will be like Kurdistan. All governorates should be like this.
Such proposals are opposed by Sunnis and by some Shiite politicians, but the fight over such issues will not restart until ministers are chosen. On Tuesday, there were reports that Sunni Arabs were continuing to demand major ministries that the parliament's Shiite majority were unwilling to grant them. Dr. Walmeet Nazmi is the former head of the political science department at Baghdad University and says that the notion of a national unity government in the country, a term that has been used by the U.S. administration as well as some Iraqi politicians, is a fallacy and that the Iraqi government continues to be marred by the lack of inclusion of those who are militarily opposing the occupation.
Well, national unity government should have been occurred in the first days of the occupation. National unity, I consider it not a unity between Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds. The national unity should have been achieved by those who were opposed to the occupation and those who supported the occupation. It is worthless effort if they don't bring the opposition, the so-called honorable resistance, to the process of political game which is being run in this country.
Walmeet also fears that those who are fighting are increasingly getting stronger rather than weaker, referring to the recent attack in Bakuba, northeast of Baghdad, that sparked 2 days of battles and the recent appearance of a video showing the face of Abu Musab Zarqawi for the first time.
With all the confirmation we take from the Americans and their allies about the destruction of the resistance, it was only yesterday or the day before yesterday that something between 100 to 500 armed people, they show an enormous strength in Diyala, Bakuba. And so the view of Mr. Zarqawi to act freely and unmasked and with full confidence with people with him around him, showed that he is still having some confidence and he's running as usual.
In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
According to the Information Clearinghouse, John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., refused to answer repeated questions about U.S. troops in Iran by Congressman Dennis J. Kucinich of Ohio, despite numerous public reports stating that U.S. troops are currently conducting operations within Iran. During the House Government Reform Subcommittee on National Security, Emerging Threats, and International Relations, Kucinich, the ranking member on the subcommittee, repeatedly questioned Bolton on the effect that U.S. troops operating within Iran will have on diplomatic negotiations already underway, including those at the U.N. Bolton refused to answer the questions about U.S. troops in Iran, but did state that the U.S. was prepared to move against Iran with or without the U.N. Security Council. In the New Yorker magazine, Seymour Hersh recently reported that U.S. troops are already operating in Iran, and retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner has made similar statements on CNN. Also, Vincent Canestraro, a former CIA counterterrorism chief, told the Guardian newspaper that special forces are operating within Iran, identifying targets and aiding dissident groups.
A roadside bomb exploded yesterday in Turkey as a Turkish military vehicle passed by in a Kurdish area, injuring 8 soldiers as well as 11 children playing nearby. The vehicle was escorting a school bus carrying soldiers' children, but none of those aboard the bus were injured. Authorities blame Kurdish rebels for the bomb, which was detonated by remote control. The explosion on a road near military barracks in the city of Hakkari also wounded 2 women. President Ahmet Nahed Sezer condemned the attack and said the rebels seeking autonomy from Turkey would never achieve their goal. Clashes between soldiers and the rebel Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, have intensified recently. Nearly 40 rebels and some 14 soldiers have been killed in fighting since the start of the year. Turkey's military has boosted its troop presence in the predominantly Kurdish southeast and massed soldiers on Turkey's Borac and Iran in an effort to prevent rebels who have bases there from infiltrating into Turkey. The PKK has been battling for autonomy for more than 2 decades in Turkey's southeast. The clashes have killed some 37,000 people since 1984.
The BBC reported that 2 military police officers are on trial in Turkey after being charged with an attack on a shop owned by a supporter of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK. One man was killed and another injured in the grenade attack last November in Semdinli, near the Iraqi border. The prosecution says the officers were part of an execution squad set up to target suspected insurgents. The accused men are paramilitary intelligence officers arrested at the scene of a grenade attack last November. Most people in this region are Kurdish, and they see the case as proof that the Turkish security forces are resorting to illegal practices, common at the height of the fighting here in the 1990s. But no senior military figure has ever been prosecuted for human rights abuses against the Kurds. There are concerns about how fair the courts in Van can be. The state prosecutor was suspended from duty after his indictment called for a parallel investigation into a senior military commander. That same commander has spoken out publicly in defense of one of the accused. Local lawyers believe these are warnings to the trial judge not to dig too deeply. Amnesty International calls it flagrant interference, warning it may have a chilling effect on the proper administration of justice.
Thousands of police armed with batons stormed an abandoned school in South Korea today to evict activists who were protesting plans to expand a U.S. military base, sparking clashes that resulted in dozens of injuries. About 3,000 police battled with hundreds of local residents and anti-U.S. protesters in the village of Pyeongtaek, where they had occupied the school building overnight to protest the expansion plans. Some 7,000 police stood nearby. Some of the protesters were seen bleeding from the head. Police said the clash left at least 65 injured on both sides. The operation was aimed at removing protesters from the site so the U.S. military can expand the nearby Camp Humphreys and move its entire command from the current headquarters in Yongsan Garrison in central Seoul. The government has offered residents financial compensation to move out of their homes, but many residents have strongly objected to the plans. South Korea and the United States agreed in 2004 on the base relocation and called consolidation plan. Nearly 30,000 U.S. troops are stationed in South Korea.
Mexican President Vicente Fox backed off signing a drug decriminalization bill that the United States warned could result in drug tourism and increased availability of narcotics in American border communities. Fox reversed course yesterday and said he was sending the bill back to Congress for changes, just one day after his office had said he would sign it into law. Fox's statements did not mention the U.S. criticism. The measure would have dropped criminal penalties for possession of small amounts of marijuana, cocaine, heroin, and other drugs. San Diego Mayor Jerry Sanders applauded Fox's decision. On Friday, Sanders said he was appalled by the bill. Earlier in the day, U.S. Embassy spokeswoman Judith Bryan said U.S. officials had urged Mexican representatives to review the legislation urgently to avoid the perception that drug use would be tolerated in Mexico. Bryan said the U.S. government wants Mexico to ensure that all persons found in possession of any quantity of illegal drugs be prosecuted or be sent into mandatory drug treatment programs.
Machete-wielding farmers who clashed violently with Mexican authorities kidnapped police officers and seized control of a town outside Mexico's capital and released all six of their hostages late last night. Shortly before midnight, radical community leaders in San Salvador and Tenco called Red Cross officials to a small clinic near the center and released the six state and federal police officers they had seized hours earlier. Organizers said it was a gesture of goodwill, since all of the former hostages injured having been beaten and some sliced with machetes. Inhabitants armed with homemade explosives who erected barricades of burning tires continued to block a major highway. Television images from helicopters overhead showed residents repeatedly punching and kicking the semi-conscious officer in a beating that continued even after he had been put inside an ambulance that took him to safety. Mexican media reported that at least three dozen police officers were injured, though federal and state police spokesmen could not agree on an exact number.
Our producer for this morning's newscast is Brian Smith. Assistant producer is Chris Andre. Engineering is Boone Rivas. The KBOO Morning News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Brian Smith.